Gallup. I'm Muhammad Yunus, and this is the Gallup Podcast. In this episode, we take a closer look at Iran's election outcome and what it means, if anything, for U.S.-Iran relations. Barbara Slavin is director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. Barbara, it's great to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. Very kind
of you. I was just joking with Barbara that I've seen her interview some of the toughest people, and now I have the hard task of interviewing her. And you have the hard task of explaining the elections in Iran and what it means for us. So let me just start by asking you, who won in the elections, who lost in the election, and does it mean anything really for the U.S.?
Well, they were strange elections, even by Iranian standards. I always have said that in Iran, the fraud takes place before the election, because there's something called the Guardian Council, which is a body that is clerics and lawyers that's appointed by the supreme leader of the country, and we can talk about that, and the head of the judiciary. And they vet all the candidates for elected office, and they usually whittle it down to very few. But what was unusual, at least over the last quarter century, there's been a modicum of choice for president. Different factions, different approaches toward the economy, toward the West. This time, basically, the Guardian Council eliminated anybody who had any chance to win against the favored candidate, who happens to be the chief of the judiciary, which also appoints members of the Guardian Council. Does this seem rigged to you? Anyway, his name is Ibrahim Raisi. He's 60 years old. He's an apparatchik. He wears a turban, so he's a cleric, and he's had some clerical training. But what he is an apparatchik of the Islamic Republic's regime. Starting at a very young age, he was brought in as a young prosecutor and signed off on many executions, including at the end of the Iran-Iraq War in 1988, some 5,000 political prisoners, people who'd already been sentenced to jail terms, were summarily executed. And Ibrahim Raisi was one of the four prosecutors who signed off on this. It was so egregious that a man named Montazeri, who was at the time the designated successor to the Supreme Leader, complained about it, said that history would remember it. And when he did this, he was dismissed as successor to the Supreme Leader. And a man named Khamenei became the successor when the leader of the revolution died. Khamenei is now apparently passing the torch to Ibrahim Raisi, who I think he sees as a sort of younger version of himself, namely a loyal soldier of the Islamic Republic who will do what he is told and will not rock the boat. So I got to say, I was in a deep funk. And many, I think, were after the election results were announced. But we had an event at the Atlantic Council yesterday. It was a really good one, I think. And we had a man on from Tehran, a professor named Sada Ziba Kalam, who was actually in a good mood. You know why?
Why?
Because the turnout in this election was so low that the number of people not voting and the number of people who put forward blank or spoiled ballots was actually the overwhelming majority of Iranians who participated or didn't participate, which means that Raisi got basically about 40-42% of the vote. And even in these very restricted circumstances with no real competition, he basically got the support of about 25-30 million Iranians, which is a pretty small base. I mean, even by Donald Trump's standards, that's a lousy base. And that's all he got.
And it is fascinating. And I'm so happy you took us through that, because one thing that a lot of people that don't know much about Iran don't realize is that even though it's not a traditional open and fair democratic process, there are so many different currents and spheres of power within the regime itself. And it's almost like a looking glass into what's happening within the regime when you see how the election turns out. Let me first ask you, Barbara, when you look at the state of things now in Iran, obviously the JCPOA is back on the table. If you are trying to lead that country right now and you are elected, what is right? What are the pressures that Raisi's really facing right now? And how do you think he'll navigate those in the near term?
Yeah, well, look, it could be quite a poison chalice, given all the problems that Iran faces. But the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the nuclear deal, was something that was negotiated by the incumbent, the current government of Iran. And it was almost destroyed by Donald Trump, who pulled out in 2018, even though Iran was in compliance with it at the time. And so the job of trying to resurrect this thing is still the purview of diplomats, actually the original diplomats who negotiated it under the current administration of the president, Hassan Rouhani. And they're working with Biden appointees who worked on this deal under Obama. They're not meeting directly. Iran refuses to sit down in the same room because they're still angry that the United States withdrew, and they say the U.S. is no longer a party to the agreement, and so it doesn't even have the right to sit in the same room. So they're passing draft texts back and forth through Europeans, Russians. They've made a lot of progress, but things kind of slowed down before the election. And the theory was that the leadership of the country, again, wanting to ensure that Raisi won, didn't want any good news, wanted everything to stay the same, wanted Rouhani to be blamed for Iran's poor economic performance over the last couple of years. And so it was kind of sitting on the process until the election was over. So now the election is over, but the new president doesn't take office until August, which means there's time to wrap this up in the next few weeks. And I still think that's quite likely, because Raisi needs sanctions relief. He needs to be able to sell oil and get money for it, or any hopes that he has of being a successful president really go down the tubes. Even with that, Iran faces so many problems. I mean, years of mismanagement, corruption, distortions in the economy, partly caused by U.S. economic sanctions, which have forced Iran to go into murky means in order to sell oil. You know, they're selling oil to China through Malaysia, and they have a variety of, I mean, they're mining Bitcoin at such a furious rate that it's causing power outages throughout the country. They're doing all sorts of things to try to get around the fact that they have been excommunicated from the international financial system. Yeah. So Raisi needs that lifted, or he doesn't have a shot at being an even moderately successful president, let alone succeeding his patron, Ayatollah Khamenei, as the real power in Iran, as the supreme leader, the theocrat who sits on top of this whole bizarre pyramid.
It is fascinating that it seems like he might reap the benefits of sanctions relief and not have to bite the bitter pill of saying, I'm the one who signed deal with the horrible Americans. It's interesting.
Yeah, well, that would suit him. He's very anti-Western. He had a press conference the other day. He said he was asked, would he meet with Joe Biden if the nuclear deal was resurrected? And he said, no, that's it. No. So, I mean, this is one scared puppy, and he's not going to look toward the U.S. for anything but the bare minimum. And he's going to be very much focused on Iran's economic relationship with China, I think, which won't, you know, ask any pesky questions about executions and human rights abuses, given its own record.
You're, of course, the director of the Future of Iran Initiative. And the future of Iran is honestly a really interesting, challenging, but also exciting topic to talk about. Young people in Iran, they are the majority of the population. We've seen in bits and spurts explosions of their expressions in different ways. We poll in Iran annually, and we know that the economic situation, it's really hard to overestimate how bad it is. Like the real employment rate that we gather all over the world, it's one of the lowest in the world in Iran. And it's a very rich country. Obviously, there's no reason that should be the case, but for the sanctions and mismanagement, chicken or the egg, which comes first. My question to you is, what do young people in Iran want to see happen there? Are they all secret Jeffersonian Democrats rooting for America and the Nationals, or do they want something different? What have you learned studying this amazing country for so long?
Yeah, you can't generalize about a population of 80 million people, of whom maybe 30 million are, you know, under the age of, or 40 million are under the age of 30. There are some who are still true believers. There are passionately religious Shia Muslims who think that Iran is the largest Shia Muslim country in the world, has a duty and responsibility to spread the ideals of the revolution throughout the Middle East. But I would say that the majority just want a decent life, like young people everywhere. They want a decent job. They want to be able to get married, have kids, and have their kids do better than they did. And that, you know, it's just, it's not happening. And you can blame the sanctions, you can blame the mismanagement. But, you know, Iran, I think somebody once estimated that they lose $150 billion a year because of brain drain. Because if you get a good degree, if you're an engineer, particularly if you're in STEM, Iran has a very good educational system. It has some of the best universities in the world, particularly for computer science, engineering, and they leave. You know, Trump got in the way of that with his stupid Muslim ban, but it's resuming. And, you know, these kids wind up at Stanford and Berkeley and MIT, and they do fabulously, and then they go work for Google and you know, whatever. I mean, they're very, very talented. And I mean, if you look at some of the CEOs from, you know, some of these major companies now, Facebook, et cetera, Microsoft, you will see many Iranian names. I think the current head of Uber is an Iranian American, among, as I say, many who were really quite successful. So they will be beating down the doors, trying to get the hell out. And that's very sad. One of the other things Raisi said at his press conference was that he wanted the diaspora to come back to Iran and contribute to Iran. This was a ticket for the Chinese to take off in the 1980s. Overseas Chinese came back with their expertise and their money. But Iranians in the diaspora aren't that stupid. You know, a lot of them came back. There are actually two waves. First was after the end of the Iran-Iraq War, under the leadership of President Rafsanjani, he invited the diaspora to come back. And they did, and actually many of them were successful for a while. But then they found themselves falling afoul of security services, getting locked up. There were, you know, unexplained murders of intellectuals. Fast forward under Rouhani, he did the same thing in 2015 after the JCPOA, a lot came back. And then the security services again began to lock up a lot of these people. We have to this day a lovely man named Siam Aknamazi in prison more than 5 years for the crime of trying to promote a better relationship between Iran and the United States, basically. So there is no security. There is no rule of law. There is no guarantee that you or your money would be safe, that your family would be safe. So as long as Iran has this system where there is no rule of law, where people's security can't be guaranteed, it's just, it's not going to attract the diaspora. It's not going to attract anybody else, really. They have to get their house in order. They have to set some rules of the road and stick by it. Now, we have a situation where the so-called conservatives have now consolidated power in Iran. All the various institutions, parliament, president, supreme leader, security services, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, very powerful military, all in the hands of so-called conservatives or hardliners. Will they be able to establish rules of the road? Will they be able to guarantee security for people who are invited to the country? If so, maybe the picture will change. But, you know, I'm not holding my breath, because even within the hardline camp, you have infighting, people exactly. who want to embarrass each other, people who don't want Ibrahim Raisi perhaps to be a successful president because maybe they want a bigger piece of the pie for themselves or their family or their faction. So, you know, it's people have compared Iranian politics to Israeli politics. You know, the old thing about you have three Israelis, you have four opinions. I mean, it's the same with Iranians. And this one thing,
it's
I'm not Iranian
across the region.
Yeah. I'm not Iranian. And, you know, and so forgive me, Iranians, for saying this, but they know it very well, that if you get ahead, you do really well, the knives come out for you. And people say, why is that person succeeding when it should be me or it should be my friends? So there's just this backbiting that goes on. And if you're in a situation where the economy's not doing well, people are not happy, you know, who are you going to scapegoat? You can't blame it on the United States forever, particularly not if you have Joe Biden, who wants to lift sanctions and get back into the Iran deal, wants Iran's nuclear program to be controlled again. Who are they going to blame?
Which is
blame Raisi.
Yeah, perfect segue to my final question, which is, what are you advising the current leadership in Washington to do? What for the United States perspective now, what's the move for the Biden team as they try to land this deal and not only think about the deal and the nuclear program in Iran, but also the behavior of the regime in the region and the destabilizing force it's been?
Yeah. Well, they're doing the right thing in trying to get the JCPOA revived. That's step number one. You can't do anything until that's done. The other thing I think they should be doing, I mean, they talk about a longer and stronger agreement. I think that's going to be hard to do. But they should be working with the region, with Arab countries, encouraging dialogue with Iran, encouraging a de-escalation of tensions. I just saw actually some very positive news, maybe a ceasefire in Yemen. I mean, wouldn't that be fantastic after all that poor country has suffered? So détente between Iran and Saudi Arabia would reduce tensions. The U.S. is withdrawing troops, which should also eliminate excuses for some of the anti-American actions we've seen on the part of Iran-backed groups in Iraq, some of the incidents we've seen in the Persian Gulf against the U.S. Navy. You know, de-escalate tensions. That's in everybody's interests. Speak in support of human rights, put a spotlight on the human rights abuses of the regime, but have dialogue. If you can. I mean, I don't know at what level. At some level, there will be dialogue, even if it's just so-called track two, you know, between think tankers, so-called. That has always gone on with Iran, and I'm sure that that will continue. Contacts through the UN mission of Iran will continue. I think that is always important. It helps to pass messages and to reduce mistrust. There's a wonderful man I quote in my book, Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Richard Armitage. He was the Deputy Secretary of State under Colin Powell. And he said that diplomacy is the art of having the other guy have your way. You can't influence people if you don't talk to them.
Yeah.
So as odious as Ibrahim Raisi may be, there will be others around him who will be less odious, who won't be sanctioned for human rights violations. Hold your nose, talk to people. And that's the only way that we're ever going to get through this. Someday, Iran and the United States will have diplomatic relations again. And maybe we have to wait for the revolutionary generation to pass from the scene before that happens. But it's 80 million well-educated people in a pivotal part of the world. We need to talk to them. They need to talk to us.
On that awesome note, that's Barbara Slavin, Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. Barbara, thank you for being with us.
You're very welcome.
That's our show. Thank you for tuning in. To subscribe and stay up to date with our latest conversations, just search for the Gallup Podcast wherever you podcast. And for more key findings from Gallup News, go to news.gallup.com or follow us on Twitter at Gallup News. If you have suggestions for the show, email podcast@gallup.com. The Gallup Podcast is directed by Curtis Grubb and produced by Justin McCarthy. I'm Muhammad Yunus, and this is Gallup, reporting on the will of the people since the 1930s.